Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Six pups were born this year to Oregon's White River Wolf Pack. A video of the 2 to 3 month old wolf pups howling back and forth with their parents was captured on a trail camera by the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, whose reservation is within the park's home territory. It's thrilling to hear the call of the wild from these adorable wolf puppies in a part of Oregon that's been missing this vibrant sound for more than 70 years, said Amarok Weiss, senior West Coast wolf advocate at the Center for Biological Diversity. But if we want these wonderful animals to survive and flourish, we have to stop the Trump administration from putting an end to their Endangered Species Act protection. Today we talk with Amarok about the significance of these new wolf pups, which are an encouraging indicator of wolf recovery in Oregon. But at the same time, this litter is a reminder of the urgency to defend the laws that protect them. Amarok, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Good morning, Barbara. So glad to be here again. Thank you.
Yes, and it seems like this program has generated an awful lot of interest. So I guess people in Oregon and around are really thrilled that we have a growing number of wolves in our state. So let's start with the good news, which is what do we know about these six new puppies that are roaming around on the east side of Mount Hood?
This is the second year in a row that the White River Wolf Pack has had pups. So in fact, last year when the pack was first discovered, it was learned that they had pups at that time. And they've been occupying pretty much the same area, the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Indian Reservation, parts of Clackamas and Wasco County. And this year, again, because the tribal natural resource biologists had their trail cams out in the area where the wolves were hanging out, they were able to capture this image, which, as you said, and I think you've got posted right there on your radio show webpage. If nobody who's listening, or if everybody who's listening has not yet seen this video, you must tune in and see this video, because you see the puppies, you see them, you hear them howling, you hear their parents howling back. And at this stage of their life, these pups are about, oh, I think maybe 3 months old when that video was taken. So generally, wolf pups are born around mid-April in this latitude, this part of the hemisphere, northern hemisphere. So they would have been born maybe mid-April, and when they were born, they would have weighed about a pound at most at birth. They would have been blind and deaf, and then their eyes would have opened starting at around 2 weeks of age, and they would have started making their first howls at 3 weeks of age. And here's a really fun fact about wolves. Their ears probably weren't even working yet at 3 weeks of age, so they couldn't even hear themselves howl for a couple of days. But then the ears started working, and up until that point, up until about 5 weeks, actually, pups are nursing from their mom, and they start getting weaned at around 5 weeks. They're fully weaned maybe around 9 weeks, and then at that point, they start eating regurgitated food that their parents actually bring back to them in their stomach from a hunt. So if anybody here listening in has a dog, and if you've had the experience of coming home and having your dog lick your face, and you think it's because your dog is really happy to see you, well, that's vestigial wolf behavior. That's your dog hoping that you're going to barf up your lunch for them.
Actually, I had a dog a number of years ago. She was a puppy, and she loved the next-door neighbor lab, and she'd always go over and lick her teeth. And my partner said she thinks she's a dental hygienist. And then years later, I learned about that this is actually wolf lineage behavior.
Yep. It's a really good mutual behavior, and it helps them bond. So at this point, they're weaned. They're not very accomplished hunters yet. They would be just losing their milk teeth really right about now. They'd be really accomplished at hunting meadow mice and grasshoppers. That's about the size prey that they can manage at this point. But they will soon start, if they haven't already, joining their parents on hunting forays to learn and watch, learn how to hunt by watching their elders. Wolves have culture. They literally teach their pups how to hunt. And it is a learned behavior that takes some skill, and they're not real skilled at it at first, but maybe by the time they're a year and a half to 2 years old, wolves are capable of being skilled hunters.
One sort of silly little thing, I was just wondering when you're talking about that they can't hear when they're first born. Do wolf pups, are their ears flopped down like dogs, German Shepherds and other dogs whose ears eventually go up, or are they born with their ears up?
They're more flopped down. They're more soft and floppy. They almost look kind of like a little bit capped. And then they kind of flip up as they get older. and they get really gangly looking too. Like right about this age right now, their ears are going to look oversized, like German Shepherd pups would about this age. Their feet look really oversized. They look like dogs wearing snowshoes at this point because their feet are so oversized. They'll grow into that. But yeah, it's a good point. They have really similar features. You know, for many, many years, scientists thought that dogs were descended from wolves. And a couple of years ago, a paper came out from some researchers working in Siberia who discovered that actually wolves and dogs split off from a common ancestor about 35,000, 40,000 years ago. And so the Siberian huskies are the most closely related to wolves, but all of our dog ancestors came down from that lineage.
It's interesting. I'm just wondering if one of the reasons why we love wolves so much in this state, as long as we're not ranchers, and we'll get into that in a little bit, if it has to do with the fact that we love our dogs so much and that there's a lot of similarities between dogs and wolves. And even though I guess it's interesting that they split off genetically so many thousands of years ago, there still seems to be, particularly with certain breeds, that you can see some wolf traits, which I think maybe makes us appreciate wolves more.
I think absolutely that's the truth. I think of the dogs as the wolf in our living room, and we've done some changes to dogs that some changes seem pretty incredible. You look at a chihuahua or you look at a pug and you think that's related to a wolf, but they all do come back from this distinct lineage, and even that pug and that chihuahua are going to show some behavioral traits that you will sometimes see in wolves. For instance, how they greet each other. If you watch dogs at a dog park, you'll see different things going on there that if you're watching wolves in the wild, you will see some great similarities there. You know, and again, the licking at the mouth. So there's a number of things that are still vestigial. And I do agree with you. I think it is one of the reasons that we as humans, so many of us do love wolves, is this relationship we have with our dogs. And just as much, I think that we also love wolves because we recognize that they are just the essence, the majesty, the spirit, everything that represents wildness. We see that and we feel that in wolves. They are the heart and the beauty of wildness for so many of us.
Well, I think that's also, it's kind of a double-edged sword that we appreciate and love wildness. At the same time, we have this innate fear of wildness. And I know for myself, I was going to go hiking by myself a few years ago in Glacier National Park. And I was concerned because it's not recommended that you go by yourself because of so many grizzly bears. And for me, it was like this strange split between like really being excited to go hiking in a place where there's grizzly bears. On the other hand, I didn't want to meet a grizzly bear. So how do we balance that kind of awe and fear, because wolves have also been like the real boogeymen in particularly European-based mythology.
It's a great set of connected questions there. First of all, let's talk about safety and wolves. Wolves generally want to have nothing to do with people. If a wolf sees, hears, or smells you, they're most likely going to be gone before you even know that they're there. If they do stand around and stare at you, they're curious. You know, usually those will be youngsters who haven't seen a person in the wild before, and they're just curious. They don't know better that they should be scared yet. There are very few instances of wolves having attack types of interactions with people. And in those instances, the wolves either have been found to have rabies or they were habituated to people by people feeding them. And this will happen whether it's with wolves, with coyotes, with bears, with squirrels. We've all heard the expression, a fed bear is a dead bear. It's going to end up being the same thing for any other wildlife. If you feed a wild animal, they're going to get used to people being a source of food, and they will unnaturally come towards them. So we never want to do that. So if you're out in the wild, one thing we don't want to do is start feeding the wild animals. But other things that you can do, which would work for whether it's a wolf or a cougar or a bear, but especially for a bear, is if you are traveling in bear country, you should carry bear spray with you. It is a very, very effective device if you need it. You probably won't need it, but if you do, you'll be glad that you have it. And it's something you can use that actually is far more effective than people who think that they need to take a gun out with them to protect themselves with bears. Bear spray is far more effective. So you can be prepared. And that's something you do anyway. When you go hiking, you're prepared by bringing enough water with you. by bringing snack foods with you in case you're out longer than you expected. If you're in bear country, bring bear spray.
Actually, many years ago, I was hiking in the Olympic National Forest to the Enchanted Valley, and I think that either myself or my friend had our period during the time, which is not a great thing when you're in bear country. And one of the things that she was really into doing was singing at the top of her lungs, and we'd be hiking up there way high up in the mountains and singing as loud as we could, and we didn't run into any bears or any bears up there.
That's a great thing to do, is sing in a loud voice. Absolutely. Yes, I do the same thing when I'm hiking in bear country.
I don't know if that would help with cougars, though, because there's actually been some issues with cougars around Mount Hood. There's been a couple attacks. And in fact, one of the trails I hike a lot, there's a sign up right now that there was a recent, more than sightings of cougars, but there was somebody who was actually killed. And I don't understand, it's a whole other story, and I don't understand why that's happening now. But I think cougars are actually probably in some ways a little bit more dangerous out in the wild than wolves, because it seems like they're not as scared of people as wolves are.
Well, I think that, as I said, anytime you're hiking someplace where there's large carnivores, it's a better idea to be hiking with someone else, not yourself. If you do get into trouble, for instance, if you did get attacked by a cougar, you would have another person there who could take a stick and try to beat it away. But the thing is, even those attacks are still so, so rare. You know, there's not a whole lot of wild space left for large wild creatures anymore that need space to roam. And so the more that we can leave them that space to roam, all the better. And at the same time, if we are hiking where they live, let's just take common sense precautions.
Well, one of the things interesting, I live in the section of Portland that's really close to a wetland. It's about 170 acres, and I've been watching it in the last 25 years. We have become really rewilded, and there weren't any large mammals there when we moved to the neighborhood, but there are now a lot of coyotes and a lot of deer, and it's kind of interesting to see them spread out in this urban area, which is a very heavily wooded and for an urban area, and to see them kind of thriving. But that's something I think we would never see with wolves. And maybe we should just talk a little bit about the difference between coyotes, who are very happy in the cities, and wolves, who would probably find it the last place in the world they want to live.
You know, and I would note that it can be a little bit different in this country than in other parts of the world where wolves live. So, for instance, in Europe, they have twice as many wolves, twice as many what they call brown bears, what we call grizzly bears, and twice as many lynx as we have in the United States, in an area that has twice as many people as the United States and half the land mass. So they are actually able to live comfortably with large wildlife in much more, I guess I would say, crowded spaces. I have seen videos of wolves in Italy who at night will travel through the town across the bridge to the dump to feed on, you know, human food sources there from the garbage dump. So they have made their way into town. And the fact is, wolves will live wherever people will tolerate them. We have a pretty low tolerance level in this country for living with big wildlife, and that's really a shame. That doesn't mean we want them to be habituated. Of course, we really don't want them coming into our garbage dumps. But in general, in this country, we like to keep big space away from wildlife, a little bit different than Europe. And you are right with respect to wolves and coyotes. Certainly in this country, we see wolves tend to be more secretive animals, animals that do prefer to stay away from humans, whereas coyotes are more adaptable to human communities and less fearful of coming into cities and urban areas. There's a huge population of coyotes that live in Chicago. There are coyotes that wander into the downtown city parks in San Francisco pretty routinely. And again, in these situations, it's all the more important that we don't food habituate these animals so that they're not coming to humans for your sandwich at your picnic table.
Actually, there's a coyote that habituates my street and has made friends with my neighbor. And they have an interesting relationship. However, my neighbor, I guess one of the times when the coyote came and was howling outside her window, she realized the coyote was equally interested in her cat, who I've been urging her to keep inside. But
yeah, definitely, definitely. And just, you know, one more point on this. Thinking about, you know, urban communities and fear of wildlife, we have so much greater chance of getting injured or killed in a car accident within 3 miles of our own home. than we have of having a dangerous encounter with wildlife. When we go hiking out in the wild, you're more likely to be struck by lightning than you are to be attacked by wildlife. And when it comes to wildlife, it's actually the little critters that tend to attack people more often. Fire ants, bees, wasps. These are the types of things that more people actually suffer attacks from. So keeping it in perspective, I think, is a really good, healthy thing to do so that people can feel like it's great to go out in nature and enjoy it.
Well, you listen to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Amaruk Weiss, who's a senior West Coast wolf advocate at the Center for Biological Diversity. We're talking about the 6 wolf pups that were born this year to Oregon's White River Wolf Pack in the Mount Hood National Forest. I want to get back to these wolves that are our neighbors there in Mount Hood. And first of all, I wanted to get a sense of where they are living roughly. I mean, they're called the White River Pack. Are they actually, were they first viewed around White River? Because that's actually pretty close to the summit of Mount Hood.
I believe they were to the south of that area. I'd have to go back and look and see what the reports were when they were first reported back in 2018. But my recollection was it was a little bit south of there.
Because I'm going to be going up there today. I'm just wondering if we might run into them.
Nope. Well, yeah, I would sure keep my eyes trained on the ground to look for wolf scat and wolf tracks.
Now,
I have a guidebook with you so you can tell the difference between coyote tracks and scat and wolf scat and tracks.
We'll see if we can pick one up on the way up there. So let's talk a little bit more about the White River Pack. I mean, how big is it now? It was just discovered last year, and at that time it was basically one family of wolves?
Yeah, so there was the breeding male and female. I believe they were able to confirm 3 pups at that time. There might have been another sub-adult with them. Then this year they had the 6 pups. We do know that one of the pups from last year, after it became a sub-adult, unfortunately succumbed to injuries after trapping attempts were made to radio collar the wolves. So it's believed that likely it may have starved due to a foot injury. So this is a reminder to all of us that when wolves are being recovered and monitored in any state or under any federal recovery program, part of doing that is trapping in non-lethal traps animals to get radio collars on them to then be able to monitor their whereabouts, not just for purposes of potential conflicts, but just to know where those wolves are ranging so you know what their territory is. That could also help you decide to maybe post a notice and ask people to keep out of a particular area for a couple months if it's right near a wolf den site or something, a sensitive area. Or, you know, just having awareness of where wolves are now making their way into various parts of Oregon. Because recognize, the White River Pack is one of only 2 packs that are now either in the Cascades or west of the Cascades. The bulk of Oregon's wolf packs are in the northeastern part of the state. So having the White River Pack plus also the Rogue Pack, that's OR7's pack, down in Jackson and Klamath counties, those are our 2 important anchor packs now in western Oregon. Plus there's a set of 3 more wolves that we're seeing traveling together this last year in the Indigo Game Management Unit in Douglas and Lane counties. And they're called the Indigo Wolves. They weren't officially yet called a pack. And then there's 1 lone wolf hanging down in the Silver Lake area. So knowing if we're having wolf recovery, if wolves are making their way over, is really important. So there's important reasons to have collars on wolves. Another reason you would benefit from having a collar on a wolf is as radio collars can be set to give off a signal if a wolf is not moving at all. And that can let you know that you better go investigate and see if perhaps that wolf died. Maybe it died because it was illegally killed, because it was poached. So certainly in the beginning years of wolf recovery in the Northern Rockies, this was the only way that biologists knew that wolves were getting poached from the radio collar mortality signals. But so it's sad that we lost that one wolf from the White River Pack, likely due to a trapping injury that resulted in him not being able to hunt.
Now, I know among some wolf advocates and protectors that there's some controversy about the radio collars. This is a guy up in British Columbia, around the Queen Charlotte Islands, who wrote a wonderful book about wolves. I can't remember his name right now, but he is really opposed to radio calling, and he believes you can do adequate research just through camera traps. And I wonder how you balance those things, because it is disturbing that this wolf died from the White River pack last year. And it's also, he talks about the trauma that a wolf goes through every time that it's radio collared. So how do you balance all of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what should happen is we should be aiming towards that trend of getting away from radio collars and being able to monitor wolves through trail cameras, through hair samples that you find on, you can put a fence line area somewhere, you can capture a hair sample, you can do a DNA testing off that to determine what animal that is, what pack it might be related to. You know, it's very much like, it's like testing on human products for cosmetics, where we absolutely must get away from testing on animals, and so many companies have, because we have the ability now to test products through the use of cell lines and not harm and hurt and kill other animals to test for products for human use. And I believe that that's the direction we need to be going in terms of wolf monitoring as well. The more we develop those techniques, the more we can get away from it. And I agree, you know, if we could get away from radio collaring entirely, that would be my preference.
Now, on the other hand, if OR7 hadn't been radio collared, we wouldn't know of his saga in quite the same detail. And the other part that's kind of intrigued me, and I might have talked to you about this last summer, but around this time last summer, the orca in the Salish Sea, Telequa, was traveling many, many hundreds of miles, was making endless circles around the Salish Sea with her dead calf on her back, basically calling out to human beings. I think a lot of people interpreted it this way, and certainly how I saw it, calling out to us and saying, you better wake up. This is what you're doing to us. And it wasn't just calling to protect the other orcas in the Salish Sea who are really in danger, but also to protect ourselves. And I think you were telling me at that time, OR7 was making these interesting staging places where he just sort of make his presence known to people in very telling ways. Do you think that that's true, that the wolves, particularly someone who, or seven, who's become the, I'm not sure he was planning on being, but he's sort of the spokesperson for the wolves in Oregon, that they are speaking to us in this way, and that the radio callers in a way enable them to communicate to human beings what their needs are, as well as what our needs are to understand and appreciate wolves more?
I have no doubt that wolves and other animal nations on this planet are trying desperately to communicate with us. It's a matter of whether or not we can begin to understand. You know, you talked about how without the radio collar, we wouldn't know OR7's amazing journey. And on the one hand, you're absolutely right about that. And the fact that the world got to learn that a wolf would make that kind of foray for thousands of miles, and to learn that they do that because they're searching for a mate and territory, and to learn that as they do that, he would leave a urine marking, a scent mark, and then he would go back and check it to see if another wolf had marked over it. That's how wolves kind of invite each other to meet each other, or it's also how they tell them, this is my territory, you stay out. And right, the world wouldn't have known that but for his radio collar. But I think we're reaching a point in our stay on this planet where we need to realize that there also has to be some mystery in life, that we don't have to know everything, certainly not if it leads to harm to other species. And I think that the line that people are walking now philosophically and in their hearts and in their questions is, where is that line? At what point do we leave wildlife alone to be wild? When we have species that have been on the verge of extinction because of human activities, we owe it to them to try to restore those populations. And at a certain point, we hope to be successful in doing that. And at a certain point, it would be great if we could just leave them alone.
Well, I want to get back to this outline you sent me last night of things we're going to talk about today. And we've only hit two out of about 12 things you have here. But you wanted to talk about wolf plan revision. So let's talk about what a wolf plan is. And I wonder how the emergence of the White River pack and the fact that it's growing and seems to be doing pretty well, how does this impact the wolf plan for Oregon and for the rest of the Northwest?
Because starting with the wolf plan, first of all, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, when they decided to recover wolves in certain parts of the U.S., but not everywhere, which they should have done since wolves were listed everywhere, they only required those states where they were planning to recover them to develop a state wolf plan. Some states that weren't part of the recovery for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they decided to develop wolf plans on their own. And Oregon was one of those states, because in 1999, one of the wolves from Idaho came into Oregon. The state didn't realize that wolves were protected under Oregon's own State Endangered Species Act and demanded that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service come take their wolf and bring her back to Idaho, which they did. Shortly after, the state realized that wolves were listed under Oregon's own State Endangered Species Act, needed to be protected, and needed not to be kicked out of the state, and that, in fact, the state should develop a recovery plan, a management plan for wolves in the state. So starting in 2003, the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission appointed people, 14 people, to develop a state wolf plan by helping to advise the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife on what should be in that plan. I had the good fortune to be appointed to be one of the stakeholders to represent wolf advocate groups. There were seats at the table that were representing cattle ranchers, hunters, trappers, biologists, economists, tribal representatives, educators, rural at-large citizens, urban at-large citizens, et cetera. Over about a year and a half period, we met, and in 2005, produced with ODF&W the state's first wolf plan, and it was adopted by the commission in December of 2005. The plan is required to be updated every 5 years. So it had an update done in 2010, which included full public hearings, meetings, comment opportunities. A few revisions were made, not many. And then the next revision was supposed to happen in 2015. Instead, the commission and the state agency decided to spend that year prematurely state delisting wolves from the State Endangered Species Act. At the time, there were only, I think, 83 wolves in the state. My organization, the Center for Biological Diversity, plus two others, Cascadia Wildlands and Oregon Wild, filed a lawsuit challenging that state delisting, and that case is still pending. So fast forward a few years after 2015, starting in 2016, the commission held a first hearing to talk about doing the state plan update. Things kind of dragged on. In the spring of 2017, ODFW produced a first draft revision. None of the parties were happy with it. They went back to the drawing board. They came out with another version in November of 2017, and the parties still were not happy with the revisions that were in the plan. So things kind of sat still for a while. Many of us went to Governor Brown and said, could you please get your agency to engage a facilitator or a mediator, actually, is what we need to bring the stakeholders to the table and see what we can work out that would be agreeable revisions to the plan. So meetings were held starting last summer, 2018, I think maybe June or July. Meetings went through December. There was supposed to be a final meeting in January of 2019. And the conservation groups decided we would not attend that last meeting because right after the December meeting, the agency announced that they were going to put forward to the commission revisions that none of us had agreed to. They weren't even what you might call some kind of compromise, though we actually weren't seeking compromise. We were seeking terms that all of us could mutually agree to and find worked for our needs. But because the agency did that, and because the agency threw out totally many proposals that the conservation groups put forward, it was clear to us that they weren't interested in our voice. They weren't interested in what we had to say on behalf of the thousands and thousands of Oregonians we represented. So we did not go to the January meeting. The commission ended up holding public hearings finally in, June of this year. Yeah, June 4th, I believe it was. And they had received thousands of comments from people. Most people were opposed to the revisions that the state was suggesting. But regardless, the commission went ahead and voted to make some changes to the plan that we think are not in the best interests of wolves and certainly don't represent the viewpoint of people who want to conserve and recover this species. So the key things that happened is the commission voted to adopt a revision that allows the agency, ODFW, to kill wolves for livestock conflicts too quickly without sufficient use first of non-lethal conflict deterrence measures. And they also left in the plan a provision that opens the door to trophy hunting of wolves despite overwhelming public opposition to wolf hunting. And I can break down what those two things are, but I'm going to pause here for a moment.
Actually, I need to do a little station identification. So we're listening, right? We're talking this morning with Amarok Weiss here on Locus Focus. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. And we are here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking about the six wolf pups that were born on the east side of Mount Hood this last few months. And the kind of, in a way, the impact that this great news about wolf recovery here in Oregon, how it integrates into some of the issues we're still having about really seriously recovering wolves here in Oregon. So continue, Amarok, with what you were saying.
Yes. Yeah, so let me just link it to your original question about the White River wolves. So what we know is that at this point in time, wolves occupy around 12% of the habitat in Oregon that's been identified as still suitable for wolves today. And mind you, this is now about half of what was once historically occupied by wolves. And so at the rate of only occupying so far about 12% of that habitat, having wolves start to move over into the western part of Oregon and establish family packs like the White River Pack is doing, like the Rogue Pack has done, as we hope the Indigo wolves will do, this is really important news. It's something to celebrate, and it's something to be also this continued caution that the reason that we were even able to develop a wolf population in Oregon is because, first of all, there were still federal protections in place for wolves in this state. Starting in 2011, wolves in the eastern one-third of Oregon lost their federal protections when Congress stepped into some big battles and just congressionally delisted wolves there. So wolves still have federal protections in the western two-thirds of the state, where the White River Pack is, where OR7's pack is, and the Indigo wolves and that lone Silver Lake wolf. They no longer have state Endangered Species Act protections, so these federal protections are really, really important. And part of the good news in that whole line is that, first of all, Oregon has some really strong congressional representatives who have gone to bat for keeping wolves federally protected. Representative Earl Blumenauer and Pete DeFazio have been very, very strong in their support for maintaining protections for wolves. There is currently a federal proposal to strip wolves of federal Endangered Species Act protections throughout almost the entire lower 48, which include removing those federal protections in the western two-thirds of Oregon. And sadly, during the public comment for that, ODFW wrote a letter to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to the Trump administration supporting the delisting. And thank goodness, Governor Kate Brown actually stepped in and corrected that. She wrote to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and said, no, this state agency was wrong to take that position. The official state position of Oregon is we oppose federal delisting, because even she recognizes that despite whatever good or bad the Oregon wolf plan has, no matter how wolves are doing in Oregon, as a species, the gray wolf is not yet recovered throughout the lower 48 United States, and they should not be stripped of protections throughout the country.
Well, it seems that there's a bit of a contradiction with Kate Wolf, because on the one hand, she spoke quite eloquently when she opposed ODF's decision to delist wolves. On the other hand, doesn't she appoint that commission? So couldn't she appoint people who would be a little bit more understanding and also more scientific in their analysis of how wolves should be treated in Oregon?
Couldn't agree with you more. Governor Kate Brown has had an opportunity this year to actually fill 5 seats on the commission. The commission is made up of 7 members. They have staggered 7-year terms. They're supposed to be one from each congressional district and one from east of the Cascades and one from west of the Cascades. And this year, 5 seats were coming open. So far, she has appointed 4. There was a 5th one that she wanted to appoint. And the process goes like this. The governor nominates candidates, and that candidate list then goes to the Senate, and a Senate committee there confirms them. However, this year, one of the candidates that she nominated was a trophy hunter who had posed proudly with many species from other countries that he had killed as trophy animals. He also happens to be the son of one of the most outspoken wolf opponents in Oregon, the son of the head of the Oregon, former head of Oregon Cattlemen's Association and a county commissioner. There was a huge outcry, as you can imagine. Just the fact that she would be appointing a trophy hunter itself was outrageous to people in Oregon, and the clear conflict of interest of having someone on whose relative was so strongly opposed to wolves, and the son had said he would not recuse himself from matters that his father might be testifying about in front of the commission. So there was a huge outcry. Governor Brown wouldn't budge. It took the Senate committee itself to wisely decide that it was a problem and it was a conflict of interest to have this particular candidate in the commission, so they withdrew his name from the slate. So at this point, several of the new commissioners have already been seated. There is still an open seat. We hope that it can be filled by someone who does have a strong science background. Of the candidates that have been seated or appointed, at least one of them has a strong science background. The others seem to be more associated with industry, with the fishing industry and with the timber industry, and have themselves spoken and testified on things counter to some environmental policies that the governor had been putting forward that would have been helpful for fish and helpful for trees. So that's a real head scratcher there as well, and pretty disheartening.
It does seem ironic. It's something I'd love to be able to sit down with the governor, get her on the show and ask her some questions, because on the one hand, she represents the very best of everything. And on the other hand, she does these very conflicted things. And I wonder, what is she thinking when she's appointing people to the Oregon Fish and Wildlife who are in fact going counter to the very policies that she's advocating?
It'd be great if you had her on the show.
I'm not counting on it.
Interested.
Yeah, well, I'll work on that for next season. One of the kind of interesting ironies I see in the emergence of these wolf packs west of the dividing line between eastern and western Oregon, which I understand is Highway 97 that runs from Biggs down to Klamath Falls, it seems that a lot of the anti-wolf sentiment in the state is in the eastern part of the state, and this is probably also true in Washington, where there's a lot of ranchers, and the ranchers have a lot of political clout. And kind of like what the timber industry used to be on the western part of the state. On the western part of the state, which is much more urban now than it used to be, and certainly more urban than eastern Oregon, there's a lot of wolf lovers. And of course, the ranchers in eastern Oregon make fun of the urban wolf lovers and act like, and say, well, we don't know what we're talking about because we don't actually live with them. So now that we may be living with the wolves, I wonder if it's going to give the wolves a little bit more protection that they're starting to thrive in a part of the state where there's more supporters for them.
Well, I think there's 2 points that come to mind from what you've just described. One of them is you'd be surprised from the polls that have been taken over the years in Oregon how very little difference there actually is in public response to different questions regarding wolf recovery, wolf protections, whether or not wolves should be killed for livestock conflicts, whether or not non-lethal measures should first be exhausted before killing wolves. There's actually very close similarity to what the urban population says and what the rural population says. even on that issue of hunting as well, on the trophy hunting issue, I think that the percentage of people who oppose trophy hunting of wolves was even higher in the rural areas than it was in the urban areas, just by a few points. But so it's pretty shocking how close those views actually are, which tells you that it's the vocal minority that is expressing such dislike or hatred or not wanting to share the landscape with wolves in rural areas. You know, that tells you just a little bit about the voices, and it probably tells you a little bit about culture, who feels comfortable speaking out, who doesn't. And with respect to whether or not they'll be more protected on this side, you know, I think that the urban population also still has things that they need to learn about living with wolves. Many of the people that live in urban areas will often call and say, I saw a wolf, it was on this street. And I have to explain to them that, no, probably in America there wasn't a wolf walking down the street in downtown Portland. It might have been someone's pet Malamute or Husky or a wolf-dog mix. But I think that there's still a learning curve. I do think that people on the western side of the Cascades may be more outspoken, as I mentioned earlier in those surveys. When it comes to, like, media attention, they may be more outspoken. And this actually brings me to my second point, which is how the media reports on wolves can influence what a population of humans will think about them. And by that, I mean the media tends to write stories only when there are conflicts between wolves and people, or rather wolves and people's livestock. And it makes it seem as though it is a common occurrence. But in fact, wolf attacks on livestock are extremely rare. They account for 0.02% of livestock losses. And so the media doesn't tend to report on the days when wolves aren't doing something, you know, the other 360 days of the year, that wolves aren't doing something that bothers humans. And so I think that the more we can get media writing things like this wonderful news about what the White River pups. There have been news stories about whenever the Roque pack has pups. I think there was a news story when the Indigo family of wolves was discovered. The more we can get the media writing pieces about wolves just being wolves, will help folks on the west side of the Cascades also not get overly influenced by negative media reporting.
Well, actually, I was thinking in terms of wolf predation, or livestock predation. It's probably domestic dogs are a lot more dangerous to livestock, particularly to sheep, than wolves are. And I know when I was living in rural Clackamas County a number of years ago, I had a flock of chickens. I mean, some of the chickens were killed by dogs, and also and there were coyotes out there too. But it seems that people who are so concerned about the rare occurrence of wolves predating livestock should be maybe looking out for their own dogs and what their own dogs are doing to their neighbor's livestock.
You're absolutely right. You know, what the data shows is of those few percentages of livestock that are killed by predators, the top one tends to be coyotes, the next one tends to be dogs, the next one, depending upon what state you're in, is bears or cougars, and after that, bobcats, eagles, and wolves down at the very bottom. And even all of those predations combined are only about 5% of what the total losses of livestock are. Losses to livestock are instead 95% of them are caused by things like disease, dehydration, starvation, even poisonous weeds. So predation is pretty small, and you're absolutely right. I think that the latest figures I'd seen showed that dogs cause 5 times more livestock losses than wolves do.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibu Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Amrik Weiss, Senior West Coast Wolf Advocate at the Center for Biological Diversity. We started out talking about the six wolf pups that were born this year to Oregon's White River Wolf Pack on the east side of Mount Hood. And we've been talking about some more concerns about protecting wolves in this region. I want to move now to what's going on in Washington State, because I've been getting numerous emails from you and other people from the Center of Biological Diversity about some not great things that are happening with ranchers and wolves in Washington. And I wanted to compare what's happening in Washington with what's happening in Oregon and maybe what could happen in Oregon if things got out of control. So first of all, what has been happening between Washington ranchers and the wolves? Because there's, I think, actually at least as many, if not more, wolves in Washington State at this point.
Yeah, there's the annual reports come out every spring. So this spring, when Oregon released its report showing 137 wolves in Oregon, Washington released its report showing there's currently a confirmed 126 wolves in 27 packs with, I think, 15 breeding pairs. So the numbers are somewhat comparable. What we've seen in Washington has really been a situation that has the public truly outraged and have been outraged for a number of years now. Since 2012, the agency has killed 23 state endangered wolves on behalf of private for-profit livestock operators. Most of those deaths have occurred on public lands that are owned by the public. And of the 23 wolves killed so far, 19 of them have been killed for the same rancher and his operation. And the big picture message there is that Washington is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, the definition of insanity, or they're doing the same thing over and over again, not expecting a different result, but not figuring out what else they can do. And it's absurd. You know, the science shows that killing wolves for conflicts can actually be very counterproductive. You can have increased conflicts right in that same area. You can have the conflicts move to the neighbor's property. There is no scientific study that shows that killing wolves is effective to stop livestock conflicts unless you slaughter the entire pack, in which case you won't have conflicts again for maybe a year or two, until another wolf pack moves in because it's good wolf territory. But if the livestock operation hasn't changed its husbandry practices and isn't doing things to prevent through non-lethal means conflicts to start to begin with, you will see the same thing over and over again. And it's particularly true in northeastern Washington, where the terrain there's multiple grazing allotments. And there are several of them in particular that are being grazed by this one particular rancher. The region is rocky, it's steep, it's rugged, it's great wolf habitat, but it's terrible terrain for grazing cattle because it is so rocky and steep and thickly forested, which means there's also lots of downed timber that the cattle and calves can get literally trapped in to make them vulnerable to any kind of predator. Because of that, it also makes it impossible for people who are supposed to be monitoring the cattle, if they are, to be able to know where all the cattle are. The cattle have to spread out really widely to get enough nutritious forage. It's not, you know, open pasture land like folks tend to think of when they think of cattle grazing out in the field. So they're spread out widely. Because they're spread out widely, the people who are supposed to be doing what's called range riding, where they're out riding around on a horse, supposed to be monitoring the cattle, can't see where all the cattle are. And as a result, in this particular area, instead of monitoring the cattle to keep them bunched up and safe and to monitor their behavior to see if, for instance, they're nervous, which might indicate there's a predator nearby, or to be able to see if there's sick or injured cattle or calves that you should haul out of there so they won't attract predators, what happens instead is the range riders have been using the radio collar signals of the wolves to identify clusters of collar data to say, oh, wolves have been hanging out here, we better go check and look. And that's how they find dead or injured cattle. And that is a complete recipe for failure. It's not keeping the cattle protected, and the wolves all end up getting killed by a kill order that gets issued by the agency as a result. So it's a pretty horrific situation up there. Many people have been trying to work on resolving this. My organization for years has been indicating that the agency actually should put its protocol, the guidelines it's developed to decide when to kill wolves, that they should be putting that protocol through an environmental analysis as required by the State Environmental Policy Act. And in fact, we have a lawsuit pending over that. My organization, the Center for Biological Diversity, and an ally, Cascadia Wildlands, filed a lawsuit against the agency a few years ago. That case is still pending, and these situations are still arising. The agency has convened a wolf advisory group to help advise it on the protocol, but unfortunately, folks on the wolf advisory group seem to be seeking social compromises as opposed to really looking hard at what the science is saying. And what the science is showing is that the only measures that have been scientifically proven, like through a scientific experiment, to actually work to prevent wolf-livestock conflicts are specific non-lethal measures. So things are tough up in Washington, and there's a lot of people working hard to try to make it better.
Well,
there's some processes coming up soon people will be able to get involved in.
Well, it seems odd to me in a way because Washington has supposedly much stronger state environmental protection laws than Oregon, which has none. We do not have a SEPA Act like Washington has. And yet it seems like there are more problems in enforcing wolf protection in Washington as there are in Oregon. I'm not sure if that's true. It just seems like I've been hearing a lot more about wolf killing in Washington than I have about in Oregon in the last few years.
Well, one of the things that happened in Washington that many of us believe has led to some of these problems is that Washington's wolf plan, which was developed in 2011, was developed through their Endangered Species Division. And it's a really good, robust plan. It has some science in it that needs updating now. Not all the science that's known now was known then. And there's a few concepts in there that we now know are debunked. But overall, it's a really good plan. The problem was that once the commission adopted the plan, management of wolves was taken away from their Endangered Species Division and handed over to their Game Management Division staff. And if you want to talk about different cultural views, just imagine what the world view is looking through the lens of an endangered species manager versus looking through the lens of a game management staff person.
Or the sight of a rifle sight.
Of the world. Your whole view of the world and how an animal should be managed is skewed differently.
Well, what can listeners do to help, well, first of all, maybe help to support protection of wolves in Washington, and then what can we be doing here in Oregon to make sure that the White River Pack thrives and that it's these six pups live for many years and follow in the kind of the same path that the Rogue Pack has followed?
So in Washington, people should be contacting their Fish and Wildlife Commission. They should be holding private meetings with them. If you're in your district, set up a meeting for coffee and talk to them about your concerns and how you think things should be differently and what the science says. When there are commission meetings, go and testify. Even if wolves are not on the agenda, you can go speak up during the public forum portion of any commission meeting. If an item is not listed on the agenda, you can talk about it during that open public forum part. And if it is listed on the agenda, then you can talk about it after that topic is raised. So people should be constantly talking to the commissioners about that. They also should be constantly writing and emailing to Director Kelly Suswind of the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife to make your opinions and perspectives known to him also, because he's the one that ultimately makes the decision on these kill orders. And you should definitely be writing to Governor Jay Inslee, because Inslee is an individual who has prided himself on doing some great environmental work in Washington with respect to climate change, with trying to help out with what's going on with orcas. And we'd like to see the same standard of good science being applied under his watch with respect to wolves. You know, same thing with Oregon, exact same thing. Meet with the commissioners, go for coffee with them if they're in your district. Your legislators, you should not hesitate if there is a bad wolf bill that's introduced to contact any of the environmental groups that are working on wolf issues or on your own. Go in and schedule a meeting. to sit down with your legislator to let them know what you think about that bill. They need to hear from people, because otherwise all they hear from are the folks who are opposed to wolves. And remember, any of these people that you're going to sit down and talk with, they're just human beings. They may have a title, and that might seem really frightening, but they're just human beings, and you can have a sit down with them. And if you're concerned about it at all, call any of us in any of the environmental groups that are working on wolf issues in Oregon, and we'll help you through it or go there with you.
Also,
the other thing is in the federal thing to make sure that wolves remain federally protected. That's critical. The comment period just closed, but there may be more actions we'll see within the next year of folks, things that folks can do.
And also a listener called to let us know that there's going to be a Speak for Wolves conference August 9th to 11th at Portland State University. And you can go to www.speakforwolves.org for more information about that. Well, Amar,
that's right.
It's really good to talk to you. And let's check in again in a few months and see how things are going. And also if you have any more updates on the White River Wolf Pack.
Okay, sounds great. Sure. Thanks for having me on.
Great. Well, today we've been talking with Amarik Weiss, Senior West Coast Wolf Advocate at the Center for Biological Diversity, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, just go to kboo.fm or listen. You can listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm going to be taking off for the month of August, and we'll be rebroadcasting several shows from this spring, along with the recent Portland City Council Community Forum on Zenith Energy's proposal to expand the number of oil trains going through Oregon, and we'll be running that show in about 3 weeks, I believe. I'll be back live in the studio on Labor Day to talk about greenwashing, and we'll have Larry Magnin, who's fighting Jordan Cove LNG down in Southern Oregon, and Claudia Riedner, who's fighting LNG in Tacoma. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Have a great August, and thanks for listening.